Heavenly Father,
Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Friend, Beloved God,
Friend, Beloved God,
Jesus Christ,
Jesus Christ,
Babaji Krishna,
Babaji Krishna,
Lahiri Mahashaya,
Lahiri Mahashaya,
Swami Sri Yukteswar,
Swami Sri
Yukteswar, Beloved Guru,
Beloved Guru,
Paramahansa Yoganandaji,
Paramahansa
Yoganandaji, Saints of all religions,
we humbly bow to you
all.
Bless us.
With thy presence.
With thy guidance.
With thy love.
We are thine.
Eternally thine.
Be thou ours.
Om. Peace. Amen. Okay, well, this is a little different evening, and it comes with a warning for you of faint heart. This is partly serious. We answer questions, usually seriously, but in between, it's kind of like comedy hour. What happened was a few years ago, I don't know whether it was Inner Renewal Week or Winter Spiritual Renewal Week, but there was a midweek question and answer period. And we came in to a crowded room, and we were tired, and we looked around, and everybody else was tired. And so we just started, I don't know.
Actually, what Jatish said was, tell some jokes.
Tell some jokes. And we pretty much didn't stop, so.
Now, so. Ken just informed me that I am an honorary member of the Audiovisual Club. And so we will be taking questions from the audience, and Jatish will also give instructions about how they do it in India. But how we do it here, if you have a question, raise your hand, we'll point to you, and either Panduranga or Ken, or who's... Okay, Ken. We'll run to you with the mic, but when you get the mic, hold it about this close if you hold it right like that. It won't work if you hold it like that. So just have a nice personal relationship with the mic. But in India, we have learned.
This was wisdom garnered from the ages, and Keshava told us that when in India and you have a mic, you never, ever surrender it to the person who's going to answer the question or ask a question, because they'll go on and repeat 28 slokas from the Bhagavad Gita and do commercials for their healing workshops, and you can never get the mic back from them. And so we were at a conference where this happened. And finally, I think all they could do was they cut the power on the mic. And the fellow was still going on. And then we started the rest of the conference with him still holding on to the mic. So it is a little bit of a leap of faith for us to actually hand you the mic. So.
Give it to Panuranga. Now, just to start off on a serious note, we had, in the past, some house guests, and they kind of faded away. And I've been missing them lately, and I'll tell you what happened. Jatish, who, if you notice by his Monday class, has a very imaginative mind. One day I went...
She means weird.
One of my favorite things that he says is, he'll sometimes say, now here's an idea that even I don't like. And but he'll go on to share the idea. But so I went into the bathroom at our home one day, and there was the wall, the plate on the wall socket, you know, a double outlet, all the electricians perk up. And you know how the outlets, there's like two little slots and then a little hole for the, where if there's a grounding rod, is that what you said?
Prong.
Grounding prong, it goes in there. But Jatish had somehow seen something in that plate that I had never seen before. And he had gotten a marking pen, and he made little faces. And it was like a little man and a little woman. And sure enough, their little eyes were like this, and their mouth was... like that, and we called them the Oh No Twins. And whenever anything happens in life, like, oh my God, our passports are expired and we have to leave in a week, oh no, it's the Oh No Twins. But the beautiful thing is, everything always works out okay. And so instead of us getting upset, we let the Oh No Twins get upset. But then one day someone was cleaning our house and they washed off the Oh No Twins. And so I just said this morning, you know, Tatish, who I really miss. And he started naming people that have moved away or passed away. And I said, no, I miss the Oh No Twins. And so he said, I'll bring them back. So he was actually going to try to do it tonight and show you, but we didn't have time to do that.
A little show and tell. But the artists in the crowd, you too can make your own Oh No Twins in your own house. I was thinking of trying to patent the idea, but, you know.
Sell it on Amazon.
Yeah. Now, the other house guests that we have had are somehow there's either an entrance or multiple entrances into our house for mice. And we have little have-a-heart traps, and we catch them. And a couple of years ago, we were getting so many that we started to name them after characters from P.G. Woodhouse, you know.
Archie and Birdie and Cordelia and so forth.
I think we got all the way. We had to start finding A.A. and got all the way. So since we've been back from India, which is not all that long, it was early December when we got back, we've gotten 10. This time we're just keeping score. And so we take them and we drop them off down by the pond, Nandi Pond, we call it, you know, the one off to the left as you're going over. Usually we're coming to work when we do that, and I think they immediately go home. So Davy said she wanted to get a tiny little branding iron, but I said, one smell of burnt mousy flesh, you'd be traumatized forever. So, but the worst catch and release was one winter during the time when we had a lot of snow. We caught a mouse, and Davy was so tender-hearted that she took it right outside our door and let it go there. And I think it beat her back in.
Kind of our downstairs neighbor Sahaja always apologized, said, oh, I'm so sorry. It's actually kind of fun because they got into a big bag of raisins while we were gone, and we found raisins in the most amazing places, you know, like inside Kleenex boxes and you know, shoes. You start to put on your shoes and all these raisins would fall out. So it's, you just never know where you're going to hide their little. And so it's sort of fun.
I think probably our best experience was one night Davy made some toasted almonds, a big pan, you know, like a cup or two cups of toasted almonds. And in the morning she went out and there were no almonds there. So she did what every wife naturally does. She said, did you eat the almonds? And I said, no. And then Diana was walking by. She used to live underneath. She was walking by, and Davy knocked on the window, and she said, did you come in last night and eat all our almonds? And Diana didn't even bother to answer. She just gave her one of those looks, you know, and continued on. And so the mystery was just there and passed away and was long forgotten. And then one day I said, Davy, come here. And she said, I'm busy. I said, I think you want to see this. Come here. And so she came in, and on the third shelf of a bookshelf, behind a book, was a pile of almonds. Now, in another room, naturally. So I don't know how long it took. I can't imagine one mouse doing it. So the little almond gang to chain gang down all of those almonds, run in, climb up three shelves, and hide them behind a book. We actually did not save those almonds, in case you're wondering.
One last, is this on?
Yes.
Okay, one last story about mice, and then we'll move on to other topics.
Yeah, kind of move up the food chain here.
This is a true story that happened not to us, but to Hashi. And Hashi, one Christmas time, her grown children were visiting her, and she had her car parked outside of her house. And she went out in the morning to drive to work, and her car was gone. And she kind of panicked and thought, oh my God, did someone steal the car? But having grown teenage children, she first thought of them and went in and asked all of them, did you take the car? Did you take the car? And they looked at her, Mom, we didn't take your car. And so she walked all around, and then she saw her car sort of in a gully down below her house. And she lives near another family, the Karens, and Ganesha actually had been sleeping out in a tent, and the car just passed the tent just by a few inches. And so finally they pulled the car out, and she took it to our local mechanic, Thomas, and he said, do you know what happened? Yes. The mice had chewed on the wires inside the car. They like that. When it's cold, they chew on wires. They hot-wired the car. And the car just got started and slid down the hill. And so we figured that they talk about karma and reincarnation. These little mice were part, in the former lifetime, were part of a carjacking team. And they would hot-wire cars. And so they were just using their skills again. Sure. So anyway, we have lots of fun with wildlife here.
Right.
I think my mic is...
is repaired. Okay. Okay, so we will take a question that was written in from someone who's been watching online. And the question is, how important are the higher Kriyas? And it's a good question, because the higher Kriyas are important. You know, it takes a long time to, first of all, get Kriya, and then it takes a long time to practice Kriya deeply enough and long enough so that you're ready to have the higher techniques in Kriya. And because many of you don't have it, without revealing the technique itself, the second Kriya is very, very powerful in awakening each of the chakras and awakening our connection with Om and with the spiritual eye. It works with all of those three aspects, and it is extremely powerful in doing that. And then the third and fourth Kriya are designed especially to bring the energy into the higher chakras. Master often would refer to the lower triad of chakras as being the more materialistic chakras, and the upper triad, the heart, the throat, and the medulla, or the spiritual eye, which is the reflection, as being the more spiritual chakras. And so the third and fourth initiation help to bring the energy powerfully into the upper chakras and help you keep it there throughout the day. So I would say the higher techniques are very important. Now, as we said this morning, at a certain point, we bypass all techniques, because much more important than any technique is the self-offering to God and Guru and the desire for merging with God. The techniques simply enhance that. They don't produce it, but they're tools that can enhance that desire, that intention on our part. And honestly, how many tools do we have on this path? Maybe a dozen, you know? I mean, there are variations on them, but energization, Hong Sa, Om, Kriya, those are the four main ones, and higher Kriyas. And so we don't have many techniques that Master has given us and stressed. So if we only have six techniques and you're asking about whether, or seven techniques and you're asking whether you should practice three of them or not, I would say odds are you ought to work with those three.
And you know, I would add something else. When we do the higher Kriya initiation, and Jyotish often offers this advice, and I think it's very helpful. Even if you don't have the technique, it's an important principle in the practice of meditation. He said, do you remember when Swami was taking singing lessons as a young man, and he had a very fine teacher who was trying to help him place his voice properly? And his teacher said, the voice is the only instrument that you can't see. You have to just listen to how I place my voice and then try to tune in and then do it in the same way. Well, in a certain sense, the higher Kriyas are like that. They're the most subtle of the techniques. Hong Sa is, you know, you can explain it in 5 minutes. It's relatively, the explanation of the technique is relatively simple. And then we just need to do it with concentration. But with the higher Kriyas, it's really building a bridge between kind of technical practice and that inner communion that we were talking about this morning. Because you really, I think you have to feel for yourself how to go deep with the technique. Nobody can really teach you that. And there are aspects of it that you can do more or less properly. But the important thing is, everyone is different. Every person's energy field and astral body is different. And so you yourself need to trust your own ability as a sincere devotee to really tune in to God and Guru as you practice these techniques. And little by little, as we said, they will become self-revelatory, self-revealing. And so they're very important in that sense, that you have to rely on your own attunement with God and Guru to really be able to go deep with them. And remember that when you practice them, that if you're not making the kind of progress you would like with the higher Kriyas, for those of you who have the initiation, just try to tune in more deeply to your own process, for what it feels like to you, for how you get results, how you feel energy in each of the chakras or whatever it might be. And so that will, I think it's a very important experience and very helpful in and of itself.
And as Devi was saying, it applies not just to the higher Kriyas, but to all techniques and the whole of the path. Swamiji often said that he would often define meditation more as listening, because he said prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening to God. And often we make the mistake of being too active in our meditation and not sensitive enough, not relaxed into the being nature enough to calm down and feel. You know, Master in the energization said, tense with will, relax and feel. The same is true for meditation. Do the techniques, then relax and feel the result of those techniques. And if you do that with the higher Kriyas, you will really feel the power that is there, or with any of these techniques.
Okay, you all ready? Questions? Okay, Marlene. Oh, he handed over the mic. Yeah. Oh, we trust you.
I have a friend, a dear friend, who...
Ready? I have a dear friend who has practiced Kriya. She's a Kriyaban. And she has decided to not do her Kriyas because she said she gets into such a high state of consciousness, it's hard to come out of it and do anything else. Now, what she's done instead is to find a technique that's more grounding. And I've been trying to think of advice that might be helpful for her. You know, it's hard to see her turning away from her kriyas. She's a very devotional person, very open and receptive, but she's having some type of high out-of-body experiences with her kriya practice.
Is the grounding technique she's substituting, is it on our path or different? Okay.
Well, this is complicated. First of all, I felt a wave of envy go through the crowd. Oh, darn. Yeah. But sometimes, and it's difficult to answer it generally because it is extremely individual and it will vary from time to time in an individual's life. And sometimes it is not helpful if you have responsibilities and things that you absolutely have to do. It's not helpful to do those techniques that make you absolutely unable to do those. So the sadder part is not that she decided not to do Kriya for a little while, but that she's looking to other paths because that will, and in order to ground. There are many things that she could do that are part of this path to ground that energy. But we know of a woman in India who is a judge, and she has had some very high experiences, and she can't practice anything devotional, even think devotional thoughts while at work or as she's acting as a judge, because she basically goes out of her body, which I don't know what kind of sentences you render in the courtroom when that happens, but you can see how there's a little conflict of interest there. And so she has to kind of put her spiritual path aside while she is at work. But she's staying with the path and very much looking forward to the time in the not too distant future when she can retire and devote herself more fully.
One thing I would offer as advice to your friend is just do the minimum number of kriyas, do 14. And just so that you don't break the connection with that flow of grace. And at the end of 14 kriyas, just to pray to Master, you know, we all know the story in autobiography where some pompous man comes up to Lahiri Mahashaya and asks for the higher kriyas, and Lahiri doesn't respond. And then this little postman, Brinde the postman, comes, and Lahiri asks him, "Brinde, would you like the higher kriyas?" He said, "Oh no, Master, no more kriyas. I can't even deliver. I get so blissful when I'm doing the first kriya, I can't even deliver my postage, so my mail." So, you know, it does happen, but I think we need to understand, and also what might be a good thing for your friend to do fewer kriyas, sit briefly, ask for the grace to, you know, be able to serve and let God flow through you throughout the day. And then when she gets up from meditation, do some simple grounding activity, folding the laundry, making the beds, washing the dishes, whatever it may be. But you know, she's been given a wonderful opportunity, as we all are in this lifetime, and it's just a shame to lose it. But, you know, just to go also on the tangent, when Jyotish said, "I felt a wave of envy go through the room." You know, Swami told us that he had very few experiences in meditation. He felt God's presence with him ever increasingly throughout his life. But he said, "I don't have visions or exalted things like that." So don't gauge your discipleship, your meditation practice, by what you experience. Gauge it by how much you love God. If that's ever increasing, and your desire to just give everything to him. When you get to the narrows, as Dotish was describing, if you just rush through and say, take it all away, it's fine, then you know that your meditation's bearing fruit. But don't get discouraged if you don't have experiences, as Marlene's friend has. Okay, other questions? Okay, why don't we let our guest and then Ramesh.
My question pertains to Davy's talk this morning, where you were talking about not getting involved with other vibrational paths. I live in a small town where I'm one of two Ananda Kriyabans, but there's six or seven SRF Kriyabans, and they do get together to meditate regularly, and I do go to their meditations sometimes. It's very clear to me that it's a very different vibration from Ananda. I mean, the devotion to master is certainly there, but it feels very different. It feels very different. They have a picture of Dayamata instead of Swami, and they read books by their ministers instead of Swami's books. And I guess I'm wondering about mixing that vibration.
Well, first I'll answer it humorously and then seriously. It's a little known fact that Ananda and SRF are on the same path. And then, seriously, there are differences, but if you live in a small town with six Kriyabans, I think it's more important to go to meditate together. When I was speaking of other paths, I was speaking of just different techniques altogether. So they're practicing Kriya, they're practicing, you know, all the things we've, all our techniques. They, as our Guru Brahmas, our brothers and sisters who have come to master through SRF. And it is our profound hope, as time goes by, that more and more we'll realize we're walking the same path together, and all the differences just seem so unimportant and so trivial. So that's the advice I would give.
And at this point, that bridging will come from the ground up, not from the top down. So the more mixing with devotees from SRF and devotees from Ananda that happened, I think that's a very, very healthy thing.
I would say they're extremely open to me. You know, there's never been any issue whatsoever that I've only been to Ananda and I've never been to SRF.
Very good. Okay, you could pass the mic to Ramesha. No, I'm forward.
If you hear the sound of Om, when you do Om, and you hear it loud in both ears, what step do you take after that in order to go deeper in it, in order to merge with the sound?
I would say try to bring from both ears, try to bring it to the spiritual eye and into the whole brain, and try to feel it as if it's inside your whole brain. And if you can feel it there, then try to let it descend down the spine, you know, and out through the chakras. But you don't have to think so much technically. Just try to let it descend and fill your body. And if you can do that, then try to let it expand beyond your body.
Thank you.
And the more you're able to not use yourself as a the ego as a point of self-reference, but just not I am hearing Om, but Om is. And that helps. Okay, question right here. Our friend from Seattle.
Okay. How do I get rid of these waves of envy? I've had two in the last 30 minutes.
I don't know. You just have to shake them off.
My question is, I relate to God as Divine Mother, and it feels right to me to relate to Master as Divine Mother. But, you know, having grown up Catholic, it's like, well, do I need permission to relate to Master as Divine Mother? I don't want to be doing something that, oh, you shouldn't be doing that.
Sunshine, can you answer that?
Yeah. No, I will say that you've got a whole lot better chance of getting that permission from this Pope than from the last one. So there does seem, you know, all of it is just words and just images. Divine Mother is everywhere and in everything. And the only difference between Mary and Master and any other image and all of us is that they realize that they're Divine Mother. What Divine Mother means, I'll come back to that and explain it in more detail, but everything is Divine Mother. And so whoever you go to get permission to worship Divine Mother in that form is already there waiting for you. And so just worship however you feel. Let your heart be your guide. So what is Divine Mother? We think in terms of Divine Mother and Heavenly Father. And I mean, some people even get angry that, you know, the scriptures don't contain enough goddesses. And it just gets into craziness, honestly. Divine Mother is there is only one. And so the way Lahiri Mahashaya described it is that he talked about God as prana. And prana is not just energy, but it's consciousness. And, you know, the scriptures define that consciousness as Satchitananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss. So think of that pure consciousness just existing, blissful existence. There's nothing else. There's no created, manifested world. There's just that pure consciousness. And then from time to time, that pure consciousness takes a small portion, and Lahiri said 1% of that consciousness, instead of being still, that prana, instead of being still, becomes kinetic or active. And when that consciousness becomes active, it vibrates in a polarity, and that's the sound of Om, that is that polarity or the vibration of Om. And out of that is created the manifested world. And that act of creation has been called, because we are created or born out of a mother, so that act of being born, creation being born, is thought of as Divine Mother creates that. Divine Mother gives birth to the universe. But because we're still caught in body consciousness and in duality, we think mother, father, oh, they probably have arguments and, you know, they fight and, you know, it's all just one. And so that consciousness of father and mother has to be, these images can be very helpful. Master generally worshipped Divine Mother, or that pure consciousness in the form of its creative and loving form, as opposed to the more receded and quiet form, because he was Master of great love, and it just resonated with him. But he certainly didn't fall into the delusion that he was worshiping something separate from God or separate from the Father. It was just an aspect. And so all the different gods and goddesses, they're all just aspects of the same one consciousness. But because we have different consciousnesses and different predilections, then the divine manifests in all these forms. And so when we go deep in meditation, if we have a vision, God will come into that vision in the form that we want him or her, however you want to describe it. So God comes to us in the form that feels familiar and fulfilling for us. But to think of, you know, too much separation just locks us into more delusion. So coming back, you don't need permission from anybody to worship. Worship however it feels right.
In whatever gender.
In whatever gender. Yeah. In whatever gender.
You know, just I want to also respond. We wrote a blog about this, but you know, as Jyotish was saying, in India, they have all these deities, and you see images of them everywhere. And it's so wonderful. I mean, you go into a little stationery shop to buy little hole-in-the-wall stationery shop to buy paper or pens, and there's a little altar with an image of Ganesha, and there's incense burning, and you know, it's such a part of their life. And so you see these images everywhere. But as Westerners, I have found, don't take it on face value what's going on there, because they have one of the most sacred and beloved holidays of India is their Durga Puja, where they make these beautiful, larger than life size images of the goddess Durga. And they're beautifully done and made of clay and then painted and, you know, garlanded with beautiful flowers and worshiped. And this goes on for a week. And then at the end of that time, there's a grand procession, and they take these beautiful statues of the goddess Durga, and they take them to the ocean or to the river Ganga, and they just put them in the ocean, and they dissolve. They just melt away. And so, you know, when you go into a Catholic church, I doubt if they're going to take those crucifixes off the wall and let them dissolve. You know, that's real. That's fixed. That's what God looks like. But the Indian's mentality isn't so much that way. And so we need to go deep in our path. We need to leave off the kind of forms that we were trained in and see it in a much more fluid way. And I thought one thing I wanted to add to the friend who asked about meditating with the SRF devotees. I would ask you to continue doing that, because as we said, on a grassroots movement, that's how the change will happen. And the more one-on-one we can meet and talk and befriend each other and say, hey, we love the same guru. We're moving to the same goal. All the delusion that has separated master's children will start to dissolve. So it's not only good, it's important to do so.
Now, speaking of God in the form of mother. A mother comes in and her son is sleeping. And she says, get up, you have to go to school. He says, I don't want to get up. I don't want to go to school. She says, you have to get up, you're late. He says, there are two reasons I don't want to go to school. All the children hate me and all the teachers hate me. And she says, you still have to get up. There are two reasons you have to go to school. One, you're 51 years old, and two, you're the principal.
And Jyotish did a change of pace, so I'll follow. My brother just today sent me these different an email with different funny jokes and pictures, and one was, do you ever think that the clouds look down on humanity and say, look at that one. If you squint your eyes, doesn't it look like an idiot? Okay, Rachel.
I saw a t-shirt that said, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish and he'll probably quit his job.
And one more, in this thing my brother sent, there was this great, it was a snapshot somebody had sent in, and it was clearly a little brother and sister, a little sister about 4, little brother about 6, and the little girl was all crying and teary-eyed, and they were both in this big white t-shirt, which was clearly their father's, and the mother had written on it, are getting a long time. So they were both in this t-shirt. Okay, Rachel in the back.
first of all, thank you both for the last 3 days. It's been really incredible, so thank you very much. But yesterday, Davey, you said that karma is just energy patterns and that you can change those energy patterns. How does that relate to whatever happens is going to happen to you no matter what? I just want to understand how they mm-hmm. both come together. And thank you again.
Okay, well, remember we said what you have done, you can undo. And this is the part of Master's teachings about Dwapara Yuga. And the practice of Kriya Yoga. So it's not either or. So we can't always change what's going to happen, but we can absolutely change the way we react to it.
So and the actual events.
Yeah, although we can ameliorate the event. That's possible too. You know, Master predicted world catastrophe and world upheaval, and Swami often talked about that. But Master also gave the caveat that he said, if what's causing, you know, perhaps global depression and global warfare is greed and materialistic consciousness. And Master said, if enough people, souls on this planet, begin to shift their consciousness, that what's coming can be ameliorated. Maybe it won't necessarily be totally averted, but the dire situation could be ameliorated. So by positive energy, by changing the grooves in our brain, by consciously working with the patterns of energy, just as Master said in autobiography, his horoscope showed that he would be married 3 times and widowed. And he took that horoscope and he burnt it. And he said, the seeds of past karma will not germinate when roasted in the fires of Kriya Yoga. So we can ameliorate it. And there was one, remember, if you recall in the autobiography, there was one woman that his family was really trying to marry him off to. And he married the young woman to his cousin. And so, you know, he kind of deflected the karma. But more important, really, and I see this in the lives of so many of my gurubais throughout the world, I've seen them walk through great loss, great suffering, great misfortune, but without any shadow in their eyes. I mean, I see it today in our community. Some of our members are going through health challenges. You look in their eyes and there's nothing but calmness and peace. So we can change, and the important thing here is if we walk through that with that attitude, we're done. The puzzle is over. The key is unlocked. The door is open. We walk through and it's like, it can't affect me anymore. Because I see that if I'm always centered in the joy of God, doesn't matter what happens to me.
There's another way visually to think of it. Think of karma, the beginning of creating karma, as you running like a cricket pitcher, bowler they call them, and throwing a ball against a wall, and that ball is going to hit the wall and then bounce back at you. So if you're still moving in the same direction as that act that sent the ball there, you're going to double the force of that karma coming back and hitting you. You're moving toward it, it's moving toward you, and smack. But if you turn around, meaning you turn your energy, and now you're running the other direction, that ball is still coming. But now it's going to barely tap you on the back because you've already moved in the direction that that energy is trying to get you to move in. And so we have, as devotees, all of our spiritual practice is trying to move us in the direction that any negative karma is trying to move us in the first place. And so it will have much less impact on us. That plus the fact that with our consciousness, we actually change. I just read a study today about how meditators, and this is very rigorously done study, how meditators change energy on a quantum level. And the deeper the meditators are, the more they're able to change certain aspects of the very physics of the world around us.
Just a minute, I wanted to, another thought came to me about chasing our karma. And this is sort of, you were saying about you feeling envy. Well, it's good to, you know, for purification, to experience many emotions and then leave them behind. Envy, humor, and fear. And so I wanted to tell a little story. Sometimes we have bears around the community, so just to elicit fear in your hearts. No one's ever been heard, and they keep their distance. They're mainly interested in the compost. But once Devarshi was going for a run out Sages Road, for those of you who know it, and he saw through the woods, and he saw this big form ahead of him, and he said, "What is that?" And he started running faster, and he got closer to it, and he realized it was a big brown bear. And, or are they brown or brown bear? Yeah. And then he paused, and he said, "What am I doing? I'm running after a bear." And it's sort of like that. We do that sometimes. Something intrigues us, and we start running after our karma until we catch it, and then what? So anyway, it's...
Then there's that nice bumper sticker that said, "My karma just ran over your dogma."
Okay, Panduranga.
I have a question.
Pass the mic, please.
No, this is...
No, I know.
This might be a little esoteric, but I was just trying to think about the gurus and our param gurus, and one guru to the next. And if I was born in 1830 and Lahiri was my guru, okay, and so he says, "I'm taking you to liberation," because he becomes my guru, and I pass my next reincarnation, I'm born in 1951, and here I am. There's no Lahiri, you know, potentially here I am in the States, right? Is this my path? I don't know if that's, can Master be my guru? Because Lahiri, I've already, you know, I don't know how to ask the question, but
that's...
You asked it. Yeah, that's good enough. Think of it that we're a kind of a spiritual family, and that spiritual family is together. And if the father isn't around, then the older brother is going to help you. And in fact, Master said that Sri Yukteswar was not his guru, that Krishna was his guru, Babaji was his guru, but in this life, he was with Sri Yukteswar. And so he didn't feel disloyal to Sri Yukteswar or to Babaji, but think of it, us more as a family together, and that we help each other in the particular roles that we're called on at that time. And so, especially within our lineage, I wouldn't have too much concern. On the other hand, in this lifetime, you have been born in the circumstances where you're under the care of Master and Swamiji, and so I would stay loyal to that, but not necessarily think that you couldn't have been Lahiri's disciple in a former lifetime.
It's not like I'm looking. I was just
right. Curious. Right. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if this is true or not, but more and more I have the sense that it's a mistake to separate them, the gurus, too much. Like they're a continuum. And it's sort of like, I wasn't raised Catholic, I was raised Jewish, so there isn't a lot of mystery in the Jewish religion as the way there is in Catholicism. But, you know, the mystery of the Trinity, how can God be three and be one? How can our line of gurus be five, and yet it's a lineage that comes down again and again and again, as we're told, through history with a particular mission? And so I begin to wonder, are they really separate? Or if in one lifetime we had training under Lahiri and all we did was do Kriya and we went so deep in Kriya, and then in this lifetime there's a warm handoff to Master, because at this point in time, the mission of the masters is to spread these teachings and to spread World Brotherhood communities. And so we're just serving, in a sense, the mission of the masters. And it's almost like highlighting in any particular age, a particular one of our lineage will be the forefront of a spiritual mission. And if we're born in that time, we still draw the grace of the whole line of gurus, but we are Krishna's soldiers. If we had been alive during the time of the Mahabharata, maybe we were, who knows, Babaji Krishna would have been the guru, and we would have been out there fighting the Kauravas. And so I think there's some truth in that, that there isn't a distinction as much as we think. You know, like, well, there's this saint and that saint, and St. Francis is different from St. Teresa of Avila and so forth. It's a lineage that comes again and again, as we're told, with the expressed purpose of the spiritual evolution of humanity. And each one will have a certain particular aspect of that at a certain time. And for our liberation, we just further that mission.
And I think we as a spiritual family are often together on the astral plane and on the physical plane. And we probably have thousands of people that we have related closely to over the many, many lifetimes we've been intermixing. And in this lifetime, I kind of imagine this master saying that he had a world mission and asking who wanted to help, and Swami saying, oh, I want to help. And then Swami saying, I'm going down. Who wants to go down with me? And some of us raised our hands, and others, oh, that is such a messy age. I think I'll stay here, wait another couple of hundred years. And so some didn't. But I think we're a vast spiritual family, and we take care of each other.
Sambhava, is that you?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to sit down.
Excuse me while I establish a personal relationship with this microphone.
Yes.
When I first came to Ananda, doing Ananda Yoga, there was this mantra that I've heard, and I'm not involved with the Ananda Yoga postures as much these days, but it was the mantra of bring your energy inward and upward. And that stuck with me. And it wasn't for a long time that I realized that I wasn't including expansion in meditation. I was thinking in terms of inward and upward. And then I heard Swami talk on a Treasures talk saying he had an idea to go into meditation and feel as if his consciousness was radiating through and in all of the people he was meditating with. And then he said after that point, when he started practicing that, many people would come to him and say they were having much deeper meditations. And I don't think they knew that that's what he was doing, that that's just what was the response. So the question is just thinking in terms of inward and upward incomplete in and of itself? And how can we improve the practice of expansion?
Well, I would say yes, it's incomplete in and of itself. I would say it's the main course, and that you ought to continue to have that main course as the main course, but you need some salad and some vegetables along with it. And that means to actively try to serve others even in meditation, and actively try to help, which means to take that energy that you've been trying to draw inward and upward and project it from an inner space to the outer world, as opposed to having your energy scattered and then having it projected to the outer world. So yes, primarily the techniques of this path are trying to withdraw the prana and bring it up the spine. But especially as we get to the higher chakras, it should also radiate outward. But you might think of it this way as, you know, the light bulbs up here, they have a filament. And so the energy has to come in and heat up that filament. And that filament needs to have the energy come in, and one could say complete the circuit by coming up, so inward and upward. But as a natural result of bringing that energy inward and upward, you produce light, and that light can project out and help others. So expansion is very important.
But also remember, all of the, to continue the image of an inner pilgrimage, a journey, every staff that we use as a help along the way, you'll get to a point where that isn't helpful anymore and you throw that away and you pick up another one. Doesn't mean that first staff was wrong. It just means it helped you to a certain point on the journey and then you needed to find another tool. So, you know, it's like that, you know, it's said when the soul first begins seeking truth, first they will be given books that will expand their consciousness. Then they'll be shown teachers. And finally, if their yearning keeps going on and on, they'll be brought to a true guru. It doesn't mean those books or those earlier teachers were wrong. It just they took you on the next step of your journey, and be grateful.
And many tools you just put in the tool shed because you're going to need them later.
Okay, maybe two more questions. So Jitendra, did you have a question?
Back here,
sorry. Where were you? I don't know where you
are. Yeah, at the very back.
Josette?
Yeah, Josette.
Okay.
Okay, hello. To avoid any envy, I have this friend that practices Kriya, and when the Kundalini begins to rise, the next day they're in physical pain. So the question is, are they doing it wrong? Is it right? Is it good? Is it karma? What's going on?
Yeah, again, it's complex. First of all, generally speaking, physical pain indicates that something is off. But physical symptoms don't necessarily indicate that something is off. That could just be burning up karma. There was a period in my sadhana where I would get almost like very feverish when I would meditate and do Kriya. That went on. It wasn't painful. It was just something that happened, went on for, I don't know, a few weeks and then disappeared and has never come back again. And so I think we just go through these different stages or different aspects where there's some way that the energy is manifesting. But having said that, generally speaking, if something is painful, then she needs to try to adjust something and try to find a way that it is not painful the next day. She might actually check, first of all, physiologically, because maybe she's doing something wrong in her sadhana that's tweaking a nerve or getting her off skeletally or something. And so the fact that it's occurring the next day, the pain is occurring the next day, is a little strange. Usually it's more quickly. On the other hand, sometimes meditation will bring up things psychologically or emotionally. We had a very good friend who talked about particular practices like pouring boiling water down a snake hole. And so some of those emotions, some of those hidden karmas or whatever the results of them may come up. And so there may be, she may be interpreting something emotionally or psychologically as being painful, but maybe the pain is that she doesn't want to let go of that or there's an attachment You know, when you rip a bandage off, sometimes you can interpret that as pain, but it's not necessarily bad. But again, this is very individual. It would be good for her to sit down and talk with somebody who's a more experienced meditator.
And just to add also, lest people get a little bit concerned about getting ungrounded or having pain, when Kriya is done with deep relaxation and devotion to the guru and self-offering, there isn't pain, there isn't ungroundedness. It's a beautiful, refreshing flow of energy. And if they're not experiencing that, again, find fault with the diving. You know, there's some either tension or fear that they're holding on to. So the more they can just relax, and Kriya should be the most enjoyable thing that we do. Okay, one more question.
In this age, the coin of pain and suffering has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy.
Okay, one more? Okay, Jitendra. It'll come on. It's number three.
Okay. So I had a question just about how much time and focus that we should keep aware of the advancement in science and worldly events, and because I just find that when we have such limited time to spend a little bit of energy during free time, how healthy would it be for us to keep aware of advancements in science and kind of tuning into that?
I think it's very individual. If you're interested and it helps you spiritually, you know, there are many people, myself included, Dr. Peter included, and others, who love to look for connections between science and the spiritual arts. And so for me to read something in science is something that, one, is relaxing and fulfilling to me, but is also often spiritually connected. So it isn't diverting so much as it's just looking at another facet of the same thing. But for a person who doesn't have that interest, or really what it comes down to is past karma, past lives and tendencies that one has. So if you don't have that tendency, I certainly would not recommend that you kind of force yourself to study science because it's supposed to somehow be beneficial. I mean, I had a father who relaxed by, well, the whole chaos of four children and my mother, who she enjoyed talking a whole lot more than he did, put it that way. Well, the chaos of that house was going on. My father would sit there reading calculus books and doing calculus problems for relaxation. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to everyone. It was just something that he found fulfilling. So if you find science fulfilling, good. If you find art fulfilling, good. If you find humor fulfilling, good. You know, it's nice to have a little mix, but always keep the core of what you're doing, your sadhana, your spiritual practice, and meditation.
And read, and I'll just...
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Master said that if you read for 1 hour, you should write for 2 hours. If you write for 2 hours, you should, I think, think for 3 hours. And if you think for 3 hours, you should meditate all the time.
But God has made us so different and so varied. I think he wouldn't mind me saying so, but Gyandev has a doctorate in mathematics. And one of our dear, dear friends, Uma, who serves now in our community in Assisi, she is like dyslexic with numbers. And very intelligent, very articulate teacher, very wonderful counselor, but just machines and numbers. One time she was working, when she was working here at the Expanding Light, she was in the boutique, and she was adding up a sale on the cash register, and I happened to walk by, and she said, the cash register's broken, or the adding machine's broken, it won't give me the total. And I went over and I looked and I said, Uma, you're adding it up on the telephone. And she was going like that. But when she found out that Jan-Dave had a doctorate in mathematics, she looked at him horror-stricken, and she said, why? And he said, I like it. And she just walked away totally befuddled. So,
we all just come in with different talents, you know. Sometimes it's a little frightening. I'll say, Davy has, beyond a talent, a siddhi of knowing where everything is all the time, mostly. And I'll say, Davy, do you know, in your coat pocket. And sure enough, that's where my keys are, the wallet or whatever it is. So she knows everything like that. She can find anything. But on the other hand, after about 25 years of driving down to the Bay Area, one time we were driving down, same route we'd been doing dozens and dozens of times, and she said, that's Roseville. Which we had been driving past. So I know where Roseville is, but she knows where my wallet is. So go figure.
Actually, it was such a wonderful moment when I realized they were connected. You know? Roseville was on the way to Sacramento.
So. Uma, one time, Davy and Uma were driving.
Which is not a good idea.
No, this is not. Anyway, they ended up getting totally lost because Uma insisted that they turn left when Davy thought they should turn right. And after being totally lost, Uma said, I always get left and right mixed up.
So we share all that so you won't feel envious.
Yes, right.
You know a lot of things we don't know. And it's so wonderful that way. We're all God's helping God. So God bless you all, and thank you for joining us.